Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Mike Furyk to the broadcast. Mike is the founder and CEO of Allison Advanced Learning Interactive Systems Online, a massive open online course or MOOC-based e-learning platform headquartered in Galway, Ireland. Allison is considered by some to be the first ever MOOC, as Mike launched the company in 2007. It's since become a noted global provider in the e-learning community, and in September of 2013, Allison was announced as one of six winners at the World Innovation Summit for Education Awards, an initiative of the Qatar Foundation. Prior to founding Allison, Mike founded Yak, a unified messaging telecommunications company, since acquired by J2Com NASD. He also founded Advanced Learning, a global provider of interactive multimedia courseware for IT literacy. Mike also served as acting MD of Interactive Investor and on the board of BMG Music UK. Mike holds a BBS degree from the University of Limerick and an MBA from Harvard Business School. I recently spoke with Mike in his office in Galway, and our conversation covered world-class IT principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Mike described the path Allison has taken from MOOC trailblazer to competitor in an ever-increasingly crowded competitive landscape, and the vision he has for the foreseeable future. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Well, Mike Furyk, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Good to be here, Peter.
Well, Mike, I wanted to begin with your company, Allison, Advanced Learning Interactive Systems Online. The MOOCs are getting, for good reason, a great deal of attention of late in terms of the possibility of transforming education in a variety of segments of the education sector. And a lot of money is being poured into the system. Some of the greatest minds have elected to focus exclusively on this. I was, among many reasons, very interested to speak with you because you're credited as founding the first MOOC back in 2007. So many of the companies that are based in the U.S. were founded in the past 12, 18, 24 months, whereas you have a much longer history, relatively speaking. And I wonder if we could begin with the inspiration for the idea in 2006 and 2007, as you were preparing for this. What were some of the insights that led to you focusing on this way back when?
I guess some of it was non-technical. Some of my background was working close to philanthropy and some people that were putting a lot of money into education worldwide. And from that experience, you realize that no matter how much money was being put into education, that it was still only a drop in the ocean. And it lends you to think of ways or inspires you to look at ways as which education could be provided for free, and not only the education itself, but the training itself, or the certification, as well as the training. And was basically trying to find a way to make that happen. And I'd been in the internet space since the early 90s, good fortune to do an MBA at Harvard many years ago, and walked into a dorm one day in 91 and saw somebody on AOL and just said, wow, this is going to change my life and going to change a lot of other lives. And I was actually reading a book on Google. And I spotted Google about 2 days after the two guys founded it in the lab. And I have watched their story for many, many years. And it was the first book that I saw written about their success. And I was reading it at Christmas, and this is Christmas 2005. And it just sparked off a lot of other thoughts that I'd been having and just saying, look, you know what, the cost of all of the servers, bandwidth, all of that is going down. The cost of creating high quality e-learning is going down. And at the same time, your ability to monetize a web page was going up thanks to people like Google. And that just said to me, well, wow, what an interesting business and what a phenomenal social impact you could have if you could provide education for free. And of course, the little secret here between with all the MOOCs and particularly self-paced education online is it's digital content and the marginal cost of sharing it with another person is next to zero. So that just says to you, you know, if you can create quality content, you can share with everybody. And that has been the one bugbear in education, because if you look at the education industry worldwide, it's a $3 trillion business, but it's enormously nationalistic and it's quite political because education and politics traditionally have gone very close together. But then you have the internet coming in and it commoditizes or it enables the commoditization of nearly everything. but well, digital content in any case. And that means that what everyone has been studying separately and in very traditional physical ways, it can now be done online. And it isn't to say that the digital revolution is going to change all education and it's going to replace teachers. But what I firmly believe is that where fact-based education can be put online, that is where the web is going to excel, and that's where it's going to be dominant, and that's where it's really, really going to change education. And so from those early thoughts of 2005, 2006, of course, I had a traditionally learning company among other interests, and the idea came to me saying, all right, I had seven courses on IT literacy. So I just came home, said to the wife, I'm going to change it, I can put it online, and it's going to be very, very bare and sparse and a business with no income for several years, but I believe this is the future. But we got to pioneer this because it's worth it. It's worth it because I think it's going to create a very interesting business and also the social impact. So we started off on the journey. That was 2005. That was the ideas. 2007, April 21st, we launched it with our first learner. And, you know, a lot of the early pioneering stuff was felt by us. For instance, I was selling the same material only a week beforehand, only a month and a year beforehand, and then it was free. And then when I went to the customers who could now access it for free, they turned around and they went to their bosses, and then they came back to me and they said, you know what, Mike, we'd actually prefer to pay, right? Even though it's free. So, you know, the early people back in 2007, 2008 did not believe that quality education could be provided for free. Now, of course, we've changed minds. We've over 2.5 million people online now. But it just tells you that when you start off being a pioneer, that technology is only one thing. Changing people's behavior and people's acceptance of new ways of doing things, that is far more difficult. And we have pioneered a lot of that. We have changed a lot of minds, and we have a lot more minds to change, but it's been an interesting journey for sure.
And your focus, unlike several other of the prominent MOOCs, has been on vocational courses. Has that always been the segment that you have focused on? And if so, why? And frankly, also, have you been tempted to or attempted to get into other segments of education?
Well, I think vocational is where the biggest market is, and I think that'll be proven in time. An interesting way to look at it is if you look at secondary school or high school, the amount of content that a 12-year-old to an 18-year-old or so, or roughly that around the world, around those kids learn is actually quite limited. If you look at your own kids or anyone who has kids and you look at their curriculum, what they're actually studying, a 12-year-old to an 18-year-old in Brazil is learning exactly what a kid is learning in Singapore. And when you look at that content, it actually adds up to the number of hours of content is actually quite small. And being commoditized, because this is going to be done, and the sources of this content coming online is going to happen from all around the world. All of these curriculums, the small curriculum that it is going to be actually satisfied completely with free content in a very short space of time. That's my belief. I believe that third level it's much larger, but where it is really huge is in the workplace, because today you don't have 1,000 people doing the same jobs anymore. Nearly everyone has their own unique learning pathway and their own unique job. And everyone can have their own unique training course. So instead of having hundreds to thousands of courses available online, actually what you need to have are many, many tens of millions, in fact, many hundreds of millions of specific courses for individual workers. So for me, the real action is in the workplace. And even if you look at third level, I think with third level, if you look at what's in colleges worldwide, and you look at what's at the kind of what the Americans may call associate level degree or kind of the early stages, many of the associate level degree are actually the late high school in a lot of other countries. That material is mostly fact-based, and that is going to be free online. So it's going to be very, very hard for colleges, particularly community colleges in the States, for the level of learning that they provide to actually sustain themselves by providing that same product going forward. Where they will be able to sustain themselves is at the higher level, where at master's and where at PhD. But the fact is that because anyone's going to be able to publish anything online at any time, the learning that's going to be scarce online is the stuff that's pretty new or is known by very few people. But That is a very, very small area of learning. Again, going back to the people that are going into college for the first time at 18, 19, 20, what they are learning is actually, again, very limited in size. So that is going to be commoditized. So in fact, 90% of the traditional education from secondary school to college, to certainly degree level, up to degree level, that is all going to be commoditized. And it's going to happen sooner than people can imagine, because the pace of change, particularly online, and is increasing all the time. So it is going to create quite a lot of change. So hence, going back to your original question, vocational is where the huge market is. Secondary and high school and lower level, third level, is going to be completely commoditized and is not a market that you want to get into longer term. But for the moment, on Allison, you will find high school courses, because for the workplace, it's very important. We're much more global than any of the other MOOCs, the larger MOOCs that are often talked about. And, you know, in a lot of places in the world, people don't have a high school education, and you have to go down and bring them up. And so we have a lot of STEM subjects. We have a lot of math, a lot of biology, chemistry, physics. These courses are very, very important for the workplace. And then we have a lot of third level. But more and more, you'll be seeing more corporate-focused content.
So I know that unlike a lot of other MOOCs, Mike, you have focused less on affiliating with specific universities and professors at universities, but rather thought leaders on a much wider and broader scale. How have you found your content?
There's two points that are raised there. How we find content, and then the whole affiliation issue. So let me get back to the affiliation issue in a minute. But in terms of finding content, there's a huge amount of content out there. And a lot of the courses on Creative Commons, and more of it coming online all the time. The issue for learners out there is to figure out, you know, where is the quality content, and what is it, and who is it from? And in some ways, people have, I think, rightly compared Allison with YouTube, which is with certainty the largest provider of learning online. And in YouTube, you can learn material, all right, but when you find the content, you don't know who produced it, what length it is, at what level it's at, and generally the pedagogic quality of how the learning is proceeds through the piece. Whereas with Allison, when we look at content, we take that content and we make sure that it fits our quality regime. It will be an absolute defined length period. The publisher will be checked out, and we will know exactly what level it's at. So with all of the content online, we see Allison as basically a filter for content that's in the vocational space. And there is no end of people that are producing content. It's just that when people produce content, they often come to us and say, look, we'd like it on Allison. Then we say, that's great. Let us look at the content. And then we tell them, okay, the content is good, but it needs to be in this format. So go away and fix it and send it back to us. And where it's strategic and where it's particularly interesting, we may do that for them. But there is no shortage of very good quality content out there. And, you know, on Allison, there's content from the usuals like Microsoft or in terms of IT language literacy. There's the British Council in terms of English language. And there's a lot of top brand names in particular areas. But more and more micro publishers of people who are just really, really good at what they teach. For instance, we have courses on Facebook. And anytime Facebook is created, or is changed, we get a new course as how to promote your business on Facebook. Well, you know, there's no university on earth that's going to change around a course in a couple of days and tell you that it's certified within a traditional accreditation system. You know, there's a lot of content that's very, very dynamic. And that's the future of learning, is dynamic certification, as I call it, where certifications are progressing and are mobile all the time. But you raised an interesting issue on the affiliation. We have not aligned our content with universities, primarily because the content that we're providing is vocational and it's lower level in the sense it's people in the workplace. So, you know, a lot of people on Allison learn to speak English, they learn how to type, how to use Excel, do basic project management, learn about accounting. That's the sort of stuff that they learn on Allison. And in some ways, the accreditation that's coming out of these universities is not ideal in terms of the accreditation. But for the principle of accreditation, I think accreditation, the traditional way of doing accreditation, is hugely inefficient. And it is inaccessible because it's so expensive. And more than anything, with all of the explosion of content out there, it is impossible to accredit it all in the traditional way. So something has to give, something has to change. And that's why I think that the Allison system of accreditation is so, so much more powerful. And if you're not familiar with it, it's very simple. It's that you, Peter, if you went into an interview 30 years ago and you said that you could type at 50 words per minute, they would say, great, Peter, sit down and here's a typewriter and type. And in 5 minutes time, they would see your speed and they would see the quality of your typing. And they would know for certain that Peter knew how to type at 50 words per minute. Well, the same thing is on Allison. There's over 600 courses. And if you pass a certificate or a diploma on Allison and you present it, you put it on your CV or resume when you go into an employer, the employer is able to actually go onto our website and within a minute set you up for a test on that subject. So whether it's finance or project management or whether it's Swedish or Arabic you have said that you've just learned, you will get a quick 20 or 30 question test that will very quickly show the person that's testing you whether you've done that course or not. And of course, if you're in an environment where there's a recruiter in a recruitment agency or whether you're in with an interview with an employer, that person is standing there. They're looking at the screen. They're seeing you pass this test just like they would have looked at you 30 years ago doing your typing. Now, that seems enormously simple. And they say, well, that can't work. Surely that's too simple. But actually, it's enabled by the most sophisticated thing of all, which is the Internet and the ubiquity of the Internet. Because the fact is that I can give anybody a test on anything, anywhere, on any subject now. And that's a massively powerful statement to make. I can even give you an Allison test on an iPhone. If I was interviewing you on a park bench and you told me that you were an ace on project management, I'd say, great, Peter, sit there for a few minutes. And on my iPhone, I could bring up an Allison test and I'd ask you 20 basic questions that anyone who had studied the fundamentals of project management should be able to answer. And it is frighteningly tough because, you know, I have a couple of degrees, but lots of people out there have degrees. How many of them would like to sit what their degree exam tomorrow or now? But they will put that content, they will put that they did that course on their resume. Of course they will. Because and that just shows you just how crazily inefficient the education system that we have. Like, what annoys me sometimes is how many people worldwide are really competent in some subject. And I often bring up the example of networking. You know, there are many people, young men and women across Africa, for instance, who are very good at networking. They've learned themselves. But they haven't gone in to do the Cisco CCMA test. And when they apply for a job, someone says, well, have you been certified by Cisco? And they say no. Well, then you're not going to get the job. But the fact is, if they come in with an Allison certificate in networking, and which could be the equivalent of CCMA, and they do the test, then the employer actually knows, this person actually knows what I need them to know on the job. They have not gone through the expense of getting a global certificate, but they have proved to me, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that they know what I need them to know. Now, is it really important for me to know that they indebted themselves to get this knowledge? Not at all. I want to make sure that they actually are debt-free, because they'll be a more relaxed employee if that's the case. Does it really matter where they learned anything? And this is generally with any employer. Do you really care where your people learned what they know or what you need them to know? No, the answer is no. So we have to really look at this whole certification charade that's going on globally. It really suits the status quo of people who are in colleges and who make their $250,000 salary a year. They do not want change. They want people to come inside their gates and get a very, very expensive stamp to say that they know something, when actually you don't need to go in through those gates. You can prove, you can learn, and you can prove what you know without ever going there. So you and I both know that U.S. Student debt has just passed $1 trillion. And it is horrific. That is a ginormous amount of money. And the fact is that I don't know what percentage of it, a huge amount of that is probably wasted learning. People have got degrees that are actually not a very, very powerful for them when they go looking for a job. Should they have invested in those degrees? The answer is plainly no. Of course they shouldn't. They are in debt now, and it's going to be very hard to get out of that. We need a system that allows people to do more education, not less. So that's why they have to be looking at these type of systems.
So you have one of those very expensive degrees, your MBA is from Harvard, obviously one of the great business institutions on earth. If there were the equivalent of Allison at the time that you were contemplating going to business school, do you think you would have made the same decision?
the question is very clear in my mind. Of course I would have gone to Harvard. Harvard is about who you know in your class, not about what you learn. And this is so blatantly obvious when you leave there, because you meet people with other MBAs and you know that they've worked so hard in other places. But actually, I'm being unfair to Harvard. Many of us who have done MBAs at Harvard wonder what we really got out of it when we left. But I know for a fact that they work you so hard there, and you're working at such a rate that myself included and most of my friends that have come out of there, we do work at a fierce pace, much quicker than most people, because for 2 years you are just hammered with data and requests for productivity. And it's amazing what human beings can actually step up to if they're forced. So, Harvard is a good education, but there's no question that the number one thing that you come out of there is the people that you spend the time with, the friendships you make, and the networks you have leaving it.
You mentioned earlier that you've set up partnerships with organizations like Microsoft and the British Council. How do you choose those partnerships? Is it a fairly open process? Can any company, so long as they provide the appropriate credentials, get on to Allison? Or is there a process in which a partner gets involved with the organization?
Okay, well, we invite any quality content at all. In some instances, if it's content that we don't think that will be immediately popular, we look for it sometimes costs us to put content on. One thing that's very different about our content and our platform and versus others is that ours is put up in what's called in the industry a SCORM format. So you can track everything on Allison. If you do a course and you're on for 5 or 10 minutes and you answer a few questions, that's all recorded. There's a lot of so-called MOOCs out there and other similar entities that have content on there that might be a video, but you can't really say, well, if you've done part of it and you leave, it won't record that you've gone so far in it, or it won't record progress in terms of assessment. That takes work on the front end for us to actually put up the content and chop it up so that all of that is trackable. So when a publisher comes to us with content that we think will be so popular, we sometimes ask them to foot that bill just on a cost basis. We don't want to be making money on just putting content up. Where somebody comes to us with a really, really good branded content and it's world famous and it is really, and the pedagogic content, the quality of the content is really good, then often we'll say, yes, we'll put that up, and we'll put it up pretty quickly. So it is, the unusual thing about Allison is that we're self-funded. And we haven't raised money for many years, and there's a certain pace as we put up content. But a lot of our systems are developing over time, and I'm pretty bullish about the future.
What sort of statistics do you bear in mind to gauge the health of Allison? I one that comes to mind, for instance, which has so prominently been pointed out among many of the American MOOCs, especially those affiliated with universities, very high dropout rate. But I wonder, with the focus on vocational and very practical learning, if those rates are higher. But
well, on the certification one, you really have to be comparing apples with apples. Free content is an unusual thing because people can come in and look at it and go away. And if you consider them as customers, it's like saying that everybody who comes into your shop and looks around is a customer, when clearly it's not under traditional metrics. A lot of people come in, browse, look around, and might even start the course to have a look at it. If you take the fact of how many people actually enter the course as being the sum total of people who want to possibly finish it, that's just simply incorrect. It's nonsense, frankly. What we do is we look at saying, we allow people to look around, but the statistics we look at are how many people have passed 10 minutes on the course, haven't just come in and look around, but how many people are actually, they've got past the first module and are on the second module. And in total, our certification rate for courses, even looking from the beginning, is somewhere near 18%, which is much higher than a lot of the MOOCs. Some people might say, well, 18% is quite low. Well, no, it's not. It's really, really high when you look at other statistics out there. But when we look at the statistics after the first 10 minutes, the certification rate is up near 36%. And that's very pleasing, because if you look at there's a lot of statistics about e-learning going back 10, 15 years, and it's very hard to compare a classroom situation with e-learning. E-learning is so much more intense. The learning is coming at you directly all the time. You need to respond to it. Whereas in a classroom, you can sit and browse and even fall asleep while the lecturer is talking. And it's just a different way of working. So again, it just has to go back to comparing apples with apples. In terms of statistics of looking at success or otherwise, well, we're always looking at retention rates, how many people come on and stay, how many people come back to do a second course, how many come back to do a third and fourth course. And One thing that which we find fascinating in Allison is that we have many hundreds of thousands of learners across Africa and Asia. And particularly in Africa, you see, well, if you compare it with Asia, you know, the likes of India are very fixated on certification. They want their certificate, and then they want to present it to you and say, look, we have this certificate. In Africa, people just want to learn more than necessarily the certificate. And there's, you know, we have so many people across Africa who have done perhaps even, you know, 30, 40, 50 courses on Allison. And we don't find that anywhere else in the world. Well, you still find lots of very engaged learners doing lots of stuff. But there is such an appetite and a yearning for learning in Africa, and it's such a big continent, and of course the growth rates are faster than anything else on the planet. It's something exciting, and development-wise, we're excited by it because a booming Africa, a more educated Africa, is a good thing for the world.
Can you talk a bit about the revenue model for the organization and how that has changed?
Sure. Well, it's obvious to everyone when they come on our website that there's advertising there. And that's a big part of our revenue model. We've had that from the beginning, although it's just become significant in the last 2 or 3 years. Advertising, and I've often said that advertising should be used more in education. It's there. Every kid in the world uses the web for their education, and Google and Facebook is all over it, and there's lots of advertising. But there's a couple of things about advertising that's pretty cool. One is that education is sticky. People stick around. The average time somebody studies in Allison is about 40 minutes. If they're on for 40 minutes, they're surely going to click an ad, or a lot of them do. So that means that you're getting some income from them. The one a very interesting point about Allison is the equitability of the advertising. If we have learners all around the world, but if someone clicks an ad in California, they pay for the next 100 people in Zimbabwe. Essentially, the developed world, the US, the UK, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, the Middle East, the Gulf States in particular, you know, these are the countries that provide enough income to allow us to make our content free to so many, many more people. And a lot of people like that idea. And there's a big social mission behind Allison, very determined that what we're really trying to do is use technology to make it education free and to make as much education free as possible. So it's a guiding principle. Anything on Allison that a learner absolutely needs is free. Anything that's nice to have, you pay. And we get a huge response when we started off at the beginning. We didn't have very much money for marketing, but what got us to where we are today is just simply word of mouth and massive goodwill, having tens of thousands of people who promote us across the world. But so advertising is one part of the revenue stream, and then premium services. So, for instance, we've just launched a course called Project Maths in Ireland. We don't do very much in Ireland, even though we're based here. But we have aligned the maths curriculum for the high school exactly to the national standard. And we provide that content to free to, for students all around the around Ireland. But if a school wants to put them all together in a group and puts 30 or 40 kids together in a group, they will pay, I think, the equivalent of $35 for a group. And that might seem small. But again, when you have a platform of 2.5 million people and you have lots of people buying groups, the small money adds up to something significant. It's nominal charges for added services that and volume is key. And I guess that's one thing about the Allison model, is that it wouldn't work if you didn't have volume. Once the market is there and developed, it's hard enough to get into it when there's bigger players like the Allisons and the Caseras out there now, because, you know, we're aggressively looking for the new learners, so is the Caseras, so is the EDXs. And but of course, that doesn't stop someone like an Amazon or a Google will be able to afford to get into it. But it's a tougher place to get for smaller startups.
What sort of team you have built? How many people does it take to do all that you've described in this interview?
A lot less than you would think. People from all around the world think that we're quite huge. And I guess in terms of the learning that we provide, I mean, we've provided over 100 million free learning tutorials. We actually have a team just over 30 people. We have 8 nationalities. We just had a lady join us from Bombay in India. We are our CTOs from Jordan in the Middle East, and, you know, UK, US. We have people from around, and it's a small enough group, but it's growing. Just hired another 5 people this month, so might seem small, but then we'll probably be hiring 5 people a month for the next few months, and that's fast enough growth for me.
Yeah, is everyone based in Galway, or are you in multiple countries at this point, your team?
We're mostly based in Galway. You know, it is, even though it's in the west of Ireland, it's probably the most connected country in Europe in terms of flights and access. So, you know, I spend a lot of time in the States, in the Middle East. We do an awful lot in Arabic. About 10% of our content is in the Middle East, and our traffic. Even though we're based in Ireland, as I said, maybe 4% of our traffic, maybe 3 to 4% of our traffic's in Ireland. Our biggest markets for Allison is actually the number one is still the US. It's a very important market for us. Fast followed by India and the UK. I guess one of the challenges is that the content, and it's a challenge to keep us sharp, is that in order to keep our model going, we have to have good content that is of interest to consumers and to learners in the US and in developed countries. And it makes sure that the quality of our content is compelling in the best and most competitive markets. It's important for us to do that. And then the nice corollary of that is that people coming in from the developing world can be assured that they're not getting seconds, which has been the tradition of the years, certainly with physical products, that they're getting access to the exact same learning as someone's getting in New York or DC or any place else.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing a bit about your experience and the nearly 7 years that you've been running Allison and the many successes that you've had, and best of luck for future successes.
Many thanks, Peter. Take care.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the value of a connected ecosystem to inspire innovation for tomorrow. To learn more, visit redhat.com. Listen to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.